T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Ever run across someone that's so cool that you're like, I'll never be that cool in my entire life? Even if I worked at it, I wouldn't be as cool as Bob Kendrick is. Well, he's here on the show, and I'm so glad that he's here. He joins me on the Alpamonte Ford hotline. Alpamonte Ford has 500 new and used vehicles for you to choose from out in Melrose Park. I love when I get the opportunity to talk with this man. He is great. Bob, how are you, sir?
Lawrence, man, number one, it's great to hear your voice. I'm doing well. You know, all things considered, we're hanging in there, but it's good to connect again.
You know what, Herbie, I'm going to have you call Bob right back to see if we can clean up his phone line just a little bit. Again, I always go through this where our technology has moved so far forward, where I can do the show from home, and it sounds almost as good as in a studio. But for whatever reason, phone lines, we still haven't got those quite right. And they're, like, super important now. I didn't give you Bob's credentials. He is the president of the Negro Leagues Museum in Kansas City. I was looking forward to seeing him this year because I was planning on going to see the White Sox play Kansas City in Kansas City and then go to the museum to see Bob. I had the chance to work with Bob for the White Sox Amateur City Elite program, which they do a really good job of bringing back the old East-West Shrine Game that used to be held in Chicago for the best Negro League players played in an All-Star game. And Bob and I got to call a couple innings together, which was a real experience for me. So I'm hopeful that we can get his line cleaned up because, okay, good. All right, Bob, sorry about that. I wanted to make sure that people could hear you loud and clear.
Well, you know, they always told me I have a face for radio, so I need this voice thing to work well.
Well, like I was saying, it's good to talk with you again. And I actually have a lot of people because I threw it out there and I said, look, if people want to ask Bob questions, I want them to be able to do that. So let me start with one. For Negro League history in Chicago, with the legend Rube Foster, how big a deal was Negro League's ball in Chicago?
It was tremendous. It was tremendous. The support that black baseball got there in Chicago, and of course most of that support stemmed from the success of the great Chicago American Giants. And some of your listeners may not be aware that Chicago had two Negro League franchises when this league was started in 1920, both the Chicago Giants and then Rube Foster's Chicago American Giants. Chicago Giants eventually kind of folded, but the Chicago American Giants were a mainstay there on the South Side for many, many years. And so black baseball has a tremendous history, had tremendous support there in Chicago. And as you were mentioning as I was getting reconnected, the old East-West All-Star Game, one of the greatest sporting events in American sports history that very few folks know anything about. Lawrence, they put over 50,000, man, in Chicago's Comiskey Park for the Negro League's version of the All-Star Game, debuted the same year as Major League Baseball's All-Star Game, 1933. And yes, it did outdraw Major League Baseball's All-Star Game. Because as you well know, man, it ain't no coincidence to put 50,000 in Comiskey under any circumstances. And my dear friend, the late, great Buck O'Neill, would say that black folks would come from as far west as Los Angeles, as far south as New Orleans, as far east as New York by train, converging on Chicago for that showcase event. At that point in time, Chicago was the center of the universe when the East-West All-Star Game was happening.
I always love when I see pictures of people going to baseball games back in the day, whether it's MLB or the Negro Leagues. But there is something special about the East-West All-Star Game where you see pictures from it. People were putting on their Sunday's best to find themselves watching some of the greatest players who've ever played.
Oh, no doubt. You know, this was as much as a social event as it was an athletic event or a recreation event. So, no, you went to see and you went to be seen. And so, yeah, now people were coming to those games and the star power, Lord. So, you know, you didn't know who you're going to see. You're going to run into all these great jazz musicians and all these other great legendary black entertainers. So everybody is looking good. But you know what? That was Negro Leagues baseball in general. As a matter of fact, you know, I'm saddened to some extent. This weekend would have been our salute to the Negro Leagues with the Kansas City Royals and the Los Angeles Dodgers were going to be in town. And one of the things that we've done over the last 7 years, we do an event every year called Dressed to the Nines. And it's funny, two young white kids approached me with about 7 years ago and said, what do you think about this idea to see if we can get fans to dress up and go to a ball game the way they used to going to a Kansas City Monarch game, and we want to call it Dressed to the Nines. And man, the first words came out of my mouth, damn, how come I didn't think of that? It was
I wish you would have come up with that too, because if for those, look, you can't see Bob, but I can tell you that he is one of the flyest brothers out there, and he always comes with it. So I am shocked that this wasn't something that was on your list of things to do.
No, it was just a great idea. And so the first year out, we did it about 3 weeks before Jackie Robinson Day game, and we just did a social media blitz. And we got about 300 people. We all met out at Kauffman Stadium at Rivals. Everybody's in their Sunday best. And you can see people looking around wondering what in the world is going on. Well, the Royals didn't get involved in year one, but they loved the idea so much that they then got involved, put some promotional muscle behind it, and now thousands of people come out on that Sunday. It would have been May 17th, this coming Sunday, and everybody's dressed up. And the women, all the way vintage. Y'all, they got their hats on. They got the pearls. They got the purses. The kids are rocking their little fedoras. I mean, it has just been an amazing thing to see take hold. It was so organic. You're going to come to this game one game out of the year. Let's throw it back the way the fans used to dress. And, of course, both teams are wearing Negro League uniforms. The ground crew is in vintage attire. The broadcasters are all suited up, and they're wearing their fedoras. And so I call it the most fashionable day in baseball, and that is our Dress to the Nines day. So I am really disappointed. You know, I had something special for them this week, and I'm going to have to save it now.
You're going to save it. I'm sure you're going to accessorize it, too. So next year you're going to be looking super fly. If you'd like to donate to the museum, NLBM.com is where you can donate to the Negro Leagues Museum. Bob Kendrick is the guest. What's your favorite Negro Leagues uniform and why?
Oh, man, there are so many. There really are. You know, here in Kansas City, the Monarchs were one of those few teams that had a different uni almost every year. Almost every year. And so I'm a little partisan to the 1942 Kansas City Monarch uniform because I think it has one of the most iconic caps. And for those who saw the movie Sandlot, and a lot of people, as they were celebrating the 25th anniversary of Sandlot, finally took notice that the young kid, the black kid in the film is wearing that 1942 Kansas City Monarch cap. But there are some other uniforms. Some of the old Detroit Stars uniforms are just absolutely sweet. The kind of very clean Newark Eagles uniforms are also nice. Baltimore Elite Giants. So there are any number. Now, the Chicago American Giants, Rube had a couple that were just incredible, you know, and I think that's what makes this Negro Leagues thing was so the Negro Leagues brought a level of brilliance to their uniforms. Because you have to remember, back then, Major League Baseball was playing in either white, off-white, or gray. But no pun intended, the Negro Leagues brought color to their uniforms. Yeah, and it almost matched the style of play that was signature to a Negro Leagues baseball. Fast, aggressive, daring. As you know, they would bunt their way on, steal second, steal third, and if you weren't too smart, they were stealing home. And so the uniforms that they wore almost matched that electric style that they brought to the game.
Before I get to some of the questions from the people, and a lot of people want to ask about Josh Gibson, I want to ask you about Miss Mamie Johnson, who played for the Clowns. I give me any story you can about this woman and how good she was.
Well, there were three women to play in the Negro Leagues, as you just mentioned. Toni Stone, Mamie Peanut Johnson, and Connie Morgan. And Toni Stone was the first of the three, but then she was followed by Mamie Peanut Johnson. The other two were infielders. Mamie Peanut Johnson was a 5'3" pitcher with a strong right arm, and she earned her nickname Peanut. She was facing Hank Bayless, who played for the Kansas City Monarchs. And Hank Bayless sees this woman on the mound, and in a somewhat condescending voice says, "What are you doing out there on the mound? You ain't no bigger than a peanut." She promptly struck him out. And then the nickname Peanut stuck until we lost her, sadly, in 2017. I believe it was 2017, 2018, I believe it was. Time flies these days, but she was amazing. I got to know her. I didn't get to know the other two ladies. Toni Stone, of course, there's a wonderful play on the life of Toni Stone that is touring now. Of course, like a lot of things in our society right now, has been shut down as a result of coronavirus. It is headed to D.C. It was in San Francisco, headed to D.C., and hopefully we'll get an opportunity for people to see it. I saw it last summer off Broadway, and it's absolutely amazing. It brings to life that chapter that you reflected on, the fact that there were these women pioneers who played in the Negro Leagues, and Toni Stone was the first of those three. She opened the door then for Mamie Johnson and Connie Morgan. All three were tremendously talented athletes. There's a field named for Mamie Johnson in the D.C. area where she lived and died. And so we're happy to bring to light or shine some light on that little known but profound role that women played in the Negro League.
Talking with one of the best storytellers I know, Bob Kendrick, who's the president of the National Negro League Museum in Kansas City. And you can donate. NLMB.com is the way that you can donate to the museum and to the cause. A lot of people are fascinated by Josh Gibson, and he seems to be a player who everyone still wants to know, like, what would have happened if Josh in his prime was playing against major league players. Why do you think that his story and his legend still stays with us today?
You know, there's probably no more myth, lore, or legend surrounding any athlete than Josh Gibson, Satchel Paige, and Cool Papa Bell. And the power of Gibson is still very much transcending. And what I tell people all the time, though, Lawrence, is it's not mythical. The power was very real. And even when you look at him in his batting position in old photographs, you can see the power. But for me, the thing that separated Gibson from all the other great power hitters is the fact that Gibson was a great hitter. Gibson had a lifetime batting average of .354. And in head-to-head competition against major leaguers in countless exhibition games, over .420. And what makes it even more remarkable is that he was doing it as a catcher, which is virtually unheard of. And unlike most power hitters, Josh didn't strike out a lot. Yeah, most power hitters in that era were going to strike out nearly 100 times a season. Today, as you well know, is a ridiculous 200-plus times a season that guys are striking out now. But for Gibson, he might strike out 20, 25 times in a season with that kind of power. And again, to put it or to paint a picture, my friend Buck O'Neill would describe Josh in this manner. He says he had the eyes of Ted Williams and the power of Babe Ruth rolled into one dynamic package. Yeah, he was something to behold. And I can tell you this, everywhere Josh played, he hit. He hit for power and he hit for average. They found his Puerto Rican Winter League records. He only hit .485 that season.
Yeah, just, yeah, he, you know, yeah, 485.
He was slumping, man. He was in a slump. Monty Irvin, the late great Monty Irvin, when he speaks of Josh Gibson, Gibson was such a likable guy. So he struck fear in the heart of pitchers, but he was such a nice guy that pitchers still liked him, even though he was killing them.
I mean, those are the stories. I remember back on Ted Double Duty Ratcliffe's 100th birthday, there was a whole ceremony at the South Shore Cultural Center, and I went and I just sat and I just wanted to be around a guy like that and hear his stories that he had to tell and sharing his life. This guy was a Chicago Negro Leagues legend. Part of Chicago. We love doing the Double Duty Classic when we have the opportunity over on 35th and Shields. What was your favorite story that you've heard from or about Ted Double Duty Ratcliffe?
Well, you talk about one of the colorful characters. Oh, that was Double Duty. I miss him dearly. The same year that you were referencing, we had Duty in Kansas City to help celebrate his 100th birthday. And I'll never forget this. We were sitting in an upstairs conference room here at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. We had ordered some Gates barbecue. And so Duty and Buck O'Neill and myself, a few other folks, we eating barbecue. And Duty and Buck are trading stories. And Lauren, no one had a recorder going. It was just one after another. And it's like, okay, that was good. All right, can you top this one? And they were just sitting there trading stories, and he was so good. And again, I don't want to just assume that everybody knows who we're talking about. But the great Ted Double Duty Ratcliffe, and what you probably will quickly learn is that there were great nicknames in Negro Leagues. And Double Duty is one of the great nicknames of all time. Well, he earned his nickname Double Duty when the great sports writer Damon Runyon saw Duty catch a Satchel Paige shutout in the first game of the doubleheader, pulled off the catcher's gear, took the mound, and threw a shutout in the second game of the doubleheader, and said he was worth the price of admission. He was nicknamed Double Duty until the day he died at 103 there in Chicago in 2005. He was a fixture at White Sox Park and just one of the, like I said, one of the most colorful characters. in this sports history, played on some of the greatest baseball teams of all time. I don't care if you're talking Negro Leagues or Major Leagues. The 1931 Homestead Braves, one of the great teams of all time. Duty was always a part of great teams. And he would write on his chest protector, "Thou shalt not steal."
That's what I'm talking about. I love that. Oh, as a catcher, like, I love that, that he's got that on the chest protector. "Thou shalt not steal." That's top notch. When you see players now, and it's over the last few years, we've seen more players be comfortable being a tad bit more colorful when they're out there on the field. I feel like that is a great homage to the history of the Negro Leagues.
No question. And, you know, it's really interesting because, you know, as we hear in baseball, it's this game of unwritten rules. You're not supposed to show up the pitcher. You're not supposed to do this or you're not supposed to do that. Well, I can tell you this, that didn't apply in the Negro League. So if you didn't want me to flip my bat, you better get me out. You know, that, and that was their mindset because they understood that the game was as much entertainment as it was anything else. So fans flocked to those games. And so, yeah, there was this charisma. There was this bravado that came along with it. And the major leaguers, Lawrence, would sometimes frown if the Negro League players, for instance, would, you know, dive in the hole and flip the ball behind the bat to start the double play. Well, today, that's a SportsCenter top 10 highlight every night of the week when it happens. But they would accuse the Negro leaguers of showboating. And again, like my dear friend Buck O'Neill would say, it's only showboating when you can't do it. And so, and he said, if you got something to show, show it. It's okay. You know, it's okay. And so, but the game has its own way of policing itself. It always has, always will. But they played the game with some flair, and it was entertaining. And black and white fans were coming to those games because the pace of the game was faster. There was a level of excitement that you really didn't see at a major league game, major league baseball. And again, no knock against it, was essentially a base-to-base kind of game. So a guy got on base, you moved him to second, and the big hitters came up, drove him in. Almost like the way the game is being played today, truthfully, but not in the Negro League. You know, we talked about it earlier. They dropped that bunt. They were bunting and running. They were hitting and running. There were double steals. There was constant movement. They found ways to put pressure on the defense, which is why Rube Foster was such a mastermind. That is the style of play that he preached when he formed the Negro Leagues in 1920. He was just light years ahead of his time.
Can you share the story of Ichiro coming to the museum?
Man, it's one of my favorite memories. It really is. Because he had come to the museum the year prior, unbeknownst. We didn't even know. He had snuck in. We didn't know he had been here until we saw the credit card slips of some jerseys and stuff that he bought. And he just walked around, and I was gone that day when he came in. Well, the year was 2006. Buck O'Neill passes away at age 94, a month shy of his 95th birthday. And who sends flowers? Ichiro Suzuki. Well, the following year, I get a call from Ichiro's interpreter saying he wants to meet with me. And I knew that he had been to the museum already, but God knows, you know, Ichiro wants to meet with me, I'm game. So we set up the meeting, and we're upstairs. I'm in my office today, as a matter of fact. And we're upstairs in our upstairs conference room, and he starts talking about his admiration for Buck O'Neill. And this was very genuine. They were kindred spirits. And he reaches into his bag, pulls out his checkbook, and wrote a substantial check in support of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Now, Lawrence, this is a kid from Japan who had this kind of affinity and admiration for this legendary Negro League figure that he felt compelled that he needed to do something to support Buck's cause. But when I stop and I think about why Buck and Ichiro struck up this, as I said, kindred relationship, is because I think Buck O'Neill could identify very much so with Ichiro, because he was this kid who had put up these incredible numbers in Japan, 3,000 plus hits. And when he makes the decision to come play in the major leagues, the assumption is, well, you did it in Japan, you can't do it in this league, because everybody just always assumes that the major leagues are better. Well, the Negro League players went through that same kind of situation and circumstances. No matter what they had done in the Negro Leagues, there was this prevailing belief that, oh, man, you won't be able to do it in this league. So what happens? Ichiro comes over here and lights up this league too. And so there was this connection between the two of them. And Buck, who would always hang out at Kauffman Stadium, you would always see him, and he's at BP all the time, and he's not there just talking to the players from the Royals. He's talking to everyone, and he would hang around the cage, and he's just encouraging all of these guys. You know, you can do this. Be the best you can be in this. And that struck Ichiro. And Buck was very dapper as well. And Ichiro says he admired his style. And they just struck up this heartfelt, very kindred relationship. And it just, it, I mean, be honest, you know, we always need the money. I really wanted to keep the check because it was written from Ichiro. But we cast that right, check.
But you got to cash that check, Bob. You take a picture of it, but you got to cash that check. If Ichiro's putting down money, you gotta put that to good use.
Yeah, Buck would understand. You know, Bob, you cash that check.
One more thing I got for you. A texter texted in and said, obviously, like, we've been talking about Josh Gibson, Satchel Paige, double duty, Buck O'Neill. Jackie Robinson obviously had a run in the Negro Leagues as well. Who's a player that the public maybe doesn't know about from the Negro Leagues that they should know about?
There are a bunch. But the first name, the two names that come to mind, Oscar Charleston and Martin DeHigo. And I say Martin DeHigo because I want people to understand that Spanish-speaking athlete couldn't play in the Major Leagues either. So they found sanctuary playing in the Negro Leagues. And very quickly, Martin DeHigo holds the distinction of being the only baseball player in the history of our sport to be enshrined into five different countries' baseball halls of fame.
Wow.
He's in the Mexican, Cuban, Venezuelan, Dominican, and in Cooperstown. Yeah. He's in the National Baseball Hall of Fame, played all nine positions, and played all nine of them well. Yeah, you cannot come out of Cuba and not know the name Martin DeHigo. And one of my favorite memories was in 2006 when Kenny Williams, who at that time was the GM of the White Sox, brought the entire Chicago White Sox team to experience the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. The first and only time that an entire major league team has come to take on this experience. And Kenny had promised Buck, after the White Sox had won the World Series, and we honored him with the Rube Foster Award for the GM of the Year from the American League, that he was going to bring the world champion White Sox back when the season started, and he lived up to his word. And I'll never forget, at that time, Jose Contreras was with the team. And when he walked in the museum, and he saw this life-size statue of his fellow countryman from Cuba, the great Martin DeHigo, he just lit up with pride. And all of a sudden, we established that connection and helping that Spanish-speaking athlete know that this is their legacy. This is their lineage. They don't play in the major leagues had it not been for the Negro Leagues. And then the other guy is Oscar Charleston. Oscar Charleston, Buck O'Neill would say without hesitation, the greatest baseball player he ever saw. He thought Willie Mays to be the greatest major leaguer, and most people concur, but he thought Oscar Charleston to be the best baseball player he ever saw. Yeah, the consummate 5-2 guy, Lawrence, hit for power, hit for average, could feel, could run, could throw. In 1921, led the Negro League in home runs, triples, doubles, stolen bases, and batting average in the same season. Yeah, I mean, just a physical specimen. We were celebrating Oscar Charleston this year because he was part of the first team, the first game played in the Negro Leagues, which would have been May 2nd there in Indianapolis. And he was one of the first superstars of the Negro League. And Buck O'Neill said he never saw a center fielder who could go back on a ball the way Charleston could, including Willie Mays. And the old timers in the Negro League say the closest thing to Oscar Charleston would have been Willie Mays. And I'm sure you remember the great catch that Mays makes Polo Grounds in the World Series, the great running over-the-shoulder basket catch that he makes. And honestly, the throw was better than the catch. But
I agree with you on that.
The throw was better. Everybody remembers the catch because he ran a country mile. And quite frankly, that's a home run everywhere except the Polo Grounds. But, Lauren, all the old-timers say, had that been Oscar Charleston, he'd have been waiting for that ball to come down.
He'd have been camped under it.
Waiting for it to come down.
Bob, this was delightful, and I'm so glad that you were available to talk. And already people are like, please have Bob on again. Please have Bob on again. We will definitely work on that. If you would like to donate to the museum, NLBM.com, you can donate and help Bob and his mission to share the history of the Negro League. Sir, it was my honor, and thank you so much for spending time with my audience.
Hey, Lawrence, anytime, man. I look forward and hopefully to see you sometime soon.
I'm hopeful of that, too, that we get an opportunity. Because I want to see what you're going to wear to the ballpark, Bob. Because I know it was going to be sharp. So I got to see what you were going to put on. Thank you, sir. Be well.
All right, guys. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
That is Bob Kendrick. He is outstanding. I'm glad you enjoyed that. I loved your feedback via the text zone. It was awesome. Back after this on The Score.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Let's talk a little racing. That's because there are going to be races this weekend. NASCAR is back at Darlington this weekend on Fox, and it's going to be a big moment for NASCAR. I wanted to talk about it, and Herbie and I were like, we don't talk a lot of NASCAR. Who should we talk to? And I'm sitting there last night, and I was like, I think I remember that Jim Sonnis was a big NASCAR guy. And usually when we talk to Jim Sonnis at Number Fire, like we talk to him about fantasy football and all sorts of other stuff. And then I hit him up, and I was like, aren't you a NASCAR guy? And he's like, yeah. So he's joining me now, the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford has 500 new and used vehicles for you to choose from. You should go check them out in Melrose Park. I'm so excited to have my friend Jim Sonnis on the show. You can check out his work at Number Fire, and he covers a little bit of everything. Plus, he's a guy that graduated from the Medill School, so we won't hold that against him. We will just still have him on the show. Jim, what's up, man?
I'm all good, Lawrence. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. I'm glad that you were available so you can walk us through some of this. I have a lot of questions about NASCAR returning. How important is it for NASCAR to get itself back on the track?
Yeah, I think it seems like it's been a priority for them. And I think the one advantage that they have is that it is a sport where you can social distance pretty effectively. Now, the pit crews, that's tough, but they're doing a lot to try to keep the pit crews away from other pit crews. So, like, if there were to be an illness within one of the pit crew members, ideally they could isolate that to be just the team. They're also isolating the drivers away from their own crews. So, essentially, the drivers will not come in contact with anybody at the track. So, it seems like they're taking the proper measures. I don't know if there is a way to take the actual proper, you know, methods here if you are actually racing, but it seems like they are trying to be aware of it, trying to take every measure they can. And I mean, it's going to be 5 Cup Series races in 15 days. So there's going to be a lot of NASCAR to consume. So if you're trying to get into it, now's the time to do so.
What was the impact, do you think, from the eNASCAR success? Because they were getting, you know, 1 million views per race.
Yeah, they were. And I think if you look at all esports broadcasts in, like, television history, I think they had 6 of the top 7 slots from a rating perspective. So it performed really well. I think the advantage that they had was they had actual drivers doing that. And you have the marketability of all those drivers. Dale Earnhardt Jr. is racing. Jeff Gordon came back for a couple of races. And those are names that we haven't gotten to see race in quite some time. So I think that they were able to keep the sport relevant in that time and now trying to build on that momentum. And, I mean, we've seen UFC try to do this too, trying to take advantage in areas where their sports have advantages, where they are, you know, a little more isolated and get themselves into this. And you can question if they should be out there. And I think that's a very fair question to ask. But, I mean, I think from NASCAR's point of view, I see why they're trying so hard to get out there on the track and take advantage of that momentum they've built with the iRacing when there was nothing else on.
I look at a NASCAR race occasionally. I don't really know a ton about it. But I look at that overall and go, that's a sport that doesn't necessarily need people in the crowd to succeed. Now, I'm sure that the folks at the track would be like, well, wait a damn minute. Like, we want people to come through those doors. Can it survive with just their television contract, or is there going to have to be a fan component if it's going to survive all of this?
I think that's a really good question. It's a question that NASCAR has been grappling with for a long time now, because the attendance, like, we saw ratings fall off for NASCAR over the past couple years, but before that, attendance was dropping, because I think the 2008 recession had a really big impact. Because when you think about traveling to a NASCAR race, like, you have to pay to travel because there's no quote-unquote home team for you necessarily for NASCAR. So you have to pay to travel, pay for the hotel, pay for the actual tickets. So when the recession hit, it had a pretty big impact on NASCAR. So they've kind of been grappling with this question for a while now of how much they can do without actually having fans in the stands. But I think with the TV contracts being what they are, and I think the TV contracts are a major motivator in getting these races in and making sure they still have 36 races this year, they at least have like a floor where they can get by if there are no fans. The other big thing that I think is helpful for NASCAR is that NASCAR, the sanctioning body, owns a good number of the tracks. So ideally, the actual money flow that they're getting will be able to allow them to have those races at tracks, so the tracks themselves won't go under because they're probably being propped up by the sport as a whole.
Jim Sonnis of NumberFire joining me here as we talk about NASCAR. There's going to be a race at Darlington on Sunday. What happened over the last 5 years with NASCAR? What was it, just the people trying to get themselves out of the recession, or is there something bigger at play here that NASCAR still hasn't figured out?
There were a lot of things. I think the recession was like the first thing, and that's what led to the downtick in attendance of the actual tracks. But then after that, so you had the drop in attendance because of that, but then you started to see the biggest name drivers all retire in a span of a couple of years. Jeff Gordon, Tony Stewart, and Dale Earnhardt Jr. all retired over a couple of years span. And when you are a sport that's driven by superstars, you have two of your most popular drivers all drop out at the same time, that's going to lead to some really tough ratings. So I think it was just kind of bad timing where things piled up on another. It's also obviously a sport that has sort of an older fan base, kind of similar to baseball. We're going to have some issues there inherently as well. So a combination of issues, the recession leading to one thing, a retirement of really popular drivers, and those two issues just kind of compounding to lead to one really big issue.
Do you think that we're going to see a change in the track agreements coming up next year? Because I know that there are some people that are looking at 2021 is kind of a reboot year for NASCAR overall.
Yeah, it very much is. And as a fan, I find that super exciting because they've been going to a lot of these tracks for a very long time. And there was like this model in the early 2000s where they wanted to expand. They wanted to get to new areas, like going out west, in order to gain all these new fans who are watching their races. And in doing so, they added a lot of kind of like boring cookie cutter tracks. But like you mentioned, they get out of those agreements for 2021. It gives them flexibility to maybe add another road course to the schedule. Road courses are some of the most exciting races they have the entire year. Maybe add another short track. And I think if you're trying to generate interest in the sport and get fans who had left the sport back, that's the way to do so, is get some exciting races at fun tracks, short tracks, some road courses in there too. I also think that the schedule that they have due to COVID-19 is interesting because there's been a lot of talk for a long time about about adding midweek races. And in order to get these races this full season in, they are adding midweek races. So they're going to have a Wednesday race. And I would bet they're probably going to do pretty well from a ratings perspective. So it's not just the addition of new exciting tracks to the schedule for next year, but also I'm hoping some midweek races too, and they can see out, you know, test run it here, see how it goes. But I think that there's a lot of opportunity to change things and mold things the way they want to be it. And as a fan who wants to see good races, I think that's a pretty exciting proposition.
All right, so I'm a NASCAR newbie. I'm going to tune in on Sunday. What do I need to watch? Who would you suggest that I choose to follow in this race?
I think an interesting guy to follow is Ryan Blaney. And the reason that I would pinpoint Ryan Blaney as someone to follow if you're new to the sport is that NASCAR had this really big youth infusion a couple years ago. Like when big name drivers step out, it opens the door for younger drivers to step in. And Ryan Blaney was one of the guys in that younger wave along with Chase Elliott. And both Chase Elliott and Ryan Blaney were awesome in the first four races this year before the layoff due to COVID-19. Ryan Blaney had a chance to win each of the first three races. Chase Elliott's the only driver who has won more than one stage so far this year, and he's actually won three. So both those guys performed really well. Now, the reason I think that Blaney is super interesting for Darlington specifically is because he's been pretty bad at this track early on in his career. But it's a small sample we're dealing with here. I love numbers, and the sample on Blaney at Darlington is pretty small. He was good at a track with heavy tire wear in Fontana earlier this year. He was really good in Las Vegas, which is another intermediate track. So I think that if you want to have some sort of rooting interest that could parlay into something longer term, I check out the younger guys, especially Chase Elliott and Ryan Blaney, because A, they're good, B, they're fun to watch, and C, they've been running really well this year, and I think could be legitimate contenders, not just this weekend, but also for a long time in the future too.
Jim, I appreciate your time, man. Thanks for the education. I'm going to check out the race. I'm going to stick with it. Kyle Long, like, hit me up on Twitter. Is like, you need to check it out. So I am going to check it out, and I'll have some sort of review, a very novice noob review for everyone on Monday's show.
Yeah, Kyle Long making the most of retirement with the iRace. That's been fun to watch too, for sure as well. Thanks, Lawrence. I appreciate it. Hopefully you enjoy the race, and hopefully we can get you hooked beyond that too.
All right, good. Well, then we'll talk again about this for sure. Thanks for having a few minutes for us.
Absolutely. Thank you as well. Appreciate it.
That is Jim Saunders from Number Fire. Great stuff on NASCAR. I'm going to check the race out on Sunday afternoon. McNeil and Parkins going to have a great guest, a big guest coming up on their show. I'll tell you about that next here on The Score.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Matt Spiegel is sitting in for Mac today, and that on its own face would be a reason why you should listen to McNeil and Parkins, because there's a lot of baseball stuff going on, and the baseball guy is going to be on the show. But McNeil and Parkins, in this case Spiegel and Parkins, are going to talk with Matt Nagy live. So Nagy is doing a whole thing with the beat reporters. They're going to do like a big Zoom thing, I think at 4 or 4:30. And then after he's done with that, he is going to be on The Score at 5 o'clock. So you should listen to the McNeil and Parkins show, because they're going to have the Bears head coach on. And I'm curious about how in the world you prepare a team to play without actually having the players. I'm sure Nagy has a plan, and I'm looking forward to hearing what his plan is. So 5 o'clock today on McNeil and Parkins. Check that out. Let me thank you for a second. I really appreciate that in this area of time where we don't have games that we're reacting to, that you've been all right with us going in different directions for the show. You enjoying the conversation about the Black Sox a couple days ago, you enjoying the conversation about the Negro Leagues today, like that, you have no idea, like as the host of this show, how good that makes me feel that you were into that. So thank you so much for allowing us space to do what we need to do to hang out with you for a couple hours a day. Great job, as per usual, by my right-hand man, Herb Lawrence. Have a wonderful weekend. McNeil and Parkins are coming up next. Check them out. Matt Nagy joins them at 5 o'clock. I'll see you Monday at noon right here on The Score.
Bye-bye.
Oh, you tripping. I'm out of here anyway. Peace out.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.